New York, this is Democracy Now.
They're not going to be fighting each other. They've had it. They've had a big fight, like two kids in a schoolyard. You know, they fight like hell. You can't stop them. Let them fight for about 2-3 minutes. Then it's easier to stop them.
And then Daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
You have to use strong language. Every once in a while, you have to use a certain word.
President Trump is back in Washington after the NATO summit, where the NATO chief calls him Daddy. The Iranian supreme leader claims victory in a new video message. We'll speak to Professor Joubert Ashkar about Iran, NATO, and Gaza. But first, as Zohran Mamdani's primary victory in New York sends shockwaves through the Democratic establishment, we'll speak to former Labor Secretary Robert Reich about wealth and inequality, the name of his Last Class, which is also the name of the new documentary about Reich.
I try to be mindful of the world these students are entering. I was talking with some of them recently, and I asked, you're no longer Generation Z. What do you call yourself? What's the generation after Generation Z? What are you? And they, several of them said, we're the last generation.
We look at Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s war on vaccines as the U.S. has withdrawn its pledge to fend Gavi, the world's preeminent international vaccine organization, and RFK's new vaccine committee has its first meeting. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump and senior administration officials are pushing back on a leaked U.S. intelligence report that suggests the U.S. strikes on Iran only set back Iran's nuclear program by a few months. On Wednesday, CIA Director John Ratcliffe and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard both insisted the strike severely damaged Iran's nuclear program. In response to the leak, the White House has announced plans to limit sharing classified information with Congress. Earlier today, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, issued a new video statement claiming victory over Israel and the U.S. while vowing Iran will never surrender.
First, I would like to congratulate them for victory over the fake regime of the Zionist regime. With all those claims that the Zionist regime were making, they almost were crushed under the blows of the Islamic government.
They were Khamenei's first public comments in over a week. Meanwhile, Iran's parliament has unanimously agreed to suspend all cooperation with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, following the U.S. and Israeli attacks that killed at least 950 Iranians, according to one count. This is the speaker of the Iranian parliament.
Despite the recent attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, the International Atomic Energy Agency has not condemned them, not even superficially. It has undermined the agency's international credibility, and for this reason, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran is suspending its cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency until the security of its nuclear facilities is guaranteed and Iran's peaceful nuclear program will proceed at a faster pace.
In other developments on Iran, Iranian state media reports authorities have arrested more than 700 people accused of having ties with Israel. At least three people were executed on Wednesday for allegedly collaborating with Israel. Officials in Gaza say Israeli forces have killed another 90 Palestinians over the last 24 hours, including dozens waiting near new food distribution centers. Israeli forces have killed over 550 people trying to access food aid over the past 4 weeks. Palestinians have described the aid sites as death traps.
We trusted the occupation soldiers after they told us to take the package. I walked past the tank and picked up the package, and suddenly they started shooting directly at us. The young men were ambushed and fell to the ground. Some were shot in the head, some in the feet.
In other news from Gaza, 7 Israeli soldiers were killed Wednesday when an explosive device was planted on their armored vehicle. It was the deadliest attack on Israeli forces in Gaza in months. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, is calling on Israel to halt all humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite warnings from the UN that the entire population of Gaza is at risk of famine. In the occupied West Bank, dozens of Israeli settlers attacked the town of Kafr Malik on Wednesday, setting homes and vehicles on fire, an attack that culminated in Israeli soldiers killing 3 Palestinians. Officials in the West Bank said the settlers were acting under the protection of the Israeli army. Meanwhile, Israeli forces fatally shot a 15-year-old Palestinian boy during a raid on Al-Yamun. Meanwhile, President Trump's called for the immediate cancellation of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's corruption trial in Israel, which is set to resume on Monday. In a rambling social media post, Trump condemned the case against Netanyahu as a witch hunt and called for Netanyahu to be pardoned. On Capitol Hill, some Republican senators are continuing to hold up President Trump's budget bill over its proposed deep cuts to Medicaid. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act would slash Medicaid spending by nearly $800 billion over a decade, eliminating health insurance for some 10 million people. On Wednesday, Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins rejected a proposal to create a $15 billion relief fund for rural hospitals, saying it failed to make up for far greater cuts. Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski and Josh Hawley have also expressed skepticism. Senate Democrats continue to condemn the budget bill. This is Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy.
What this bill represents is the biggest transfer of wealth from the poor and the middle class to the rich in the history of the country.
Shame.
Who's asking for that besides the billionaires and the corporations?
Grassroots groups representing poor and working families rallied on Capitol Hill Wednesday to demand no cuts to essential social programs like Medicaid and SNAP. This is Sarita Russell of the North Carolina activist group Action NC, whose family recently saw monthly food assistance benefits slashed from $440 a month to just $54 a month.
Our churches, which already struggles to keep their food pantries stocked, will be overwhelmed as more families turn to them for help. Our schools will see more children coming to class hungry, unable to focus on learning. Our homelessness population will grow more as families are forced to choose between rent or food. That ain't right.
The Trump administration said Wednesday it would relocate the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, outside of Washington, D.C., and into the headquarters of the National Science Foundation in Alexandria, Virginia. The move will force some 1,800 NSF workers to relocate to new offices. The American Federation of Government Employees condemned the move, writing, quote, NSF employees are being displaced with no plan, no communication, and no respect, unquote. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has withdrawn a U.S. pledge to fund the world's preeminent international vaccine organization as the Trump administration takes its campaign against vaccinations global. RFK Jr. claimed the organization, known as Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, has, quote, ignored the science of vaccinating children. Gavi says it's helped vaccinate more than 1.1 billion children in dozens of lower-income countries, preventing nearly 19 million future deaths. On Wednesday, scientists at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention rallied outside the agency's headquarters in Atlanta to protest the Trump administration's newly reconstituted vaccine advisory panel, which RFK Jr. stacked with unqualified appointees, many of them holding anti-vaccine views. This is Dr. Jody Guest, a professor of epidemiology at Emory University.
Science should serve the public, not politics. That public health is a right, not a luxury, and that people inside the agency must be allowed to do their work freely, transparently, and without fear. The stakes have never ever been higher. We all know vaccines save lives, science protects communities, and public health is worth fighting for.
Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center, author of numerous books, including Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. In immigration news, the Trump administration is planning to reject refugee status for potentially hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers in the United States, making them immediately deportable as part of Trump's sweeping mass deportation efforts. That's according to CNN, which reports Trump's plan to fast-track deportations is aimed at immigrants who entered the U.S. outside an official port of entry and later applied for asylum. New Jersey Democratic Congresswoman LaMonica McIver pleaded not guilty Wednesday to charges she assaulted an immigration officer during an official visit to a Newark ICE jail last month. The charges stem from a May 9th incident in which Congressmember McIver and two other Democratic representatives sought to tour Delaney Hall, a private prison run by Geo Corporation under contract with ICE. A criminal complaint brought by President Trump's former personal attorney, Alina Habba, who's now serving as an interim federal attorney in New Jersey, accuses Congresswoman McIver of slamming a federal agent with her forearm, forcibly grabbing him and striking another agent. McIver insists she was the one roughed up by federal officers. She spoke to supporters following her arraignment Wednesday at a federal courthouse in Newark.
This is all about political intimidation. The Trump administration and his, him and his colleagues or cronies, whatever you want to call them, have weaponized the federal government. The facts are on our side. No matter what headline they tweet about, no matter what they put on their Twitter, we know that the facts are on my side.
Mayor Ross Baraka of Newark was also charged, but the charges have been dropped against him. The three Congress members were trying to protect him. A former Justice Department lawyer has filed a whistleblower complaint alleging Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General Emil Bovee conspired with other top officials on how to mislead courts about mass deportations and to potentially ignore judges' rulings outright. The complaint was filed by lawyer Erez Rivaini, who was fired in April after he admitted to a judge the Trump administration had mistakenly transferred Maryland father Kilmar Abrego Garcia to El Salvador's mega prison due to a, quote, administrative error. Rivaini filed the complaint ahead of the Senate confirmation hearings Wednesday for Bovee to serve as a judge on the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. This is Bovee under questioning from California Democratic Senator Adam Schiff.
Did you suggest, as Mr. Rivaini wrote, that DOJ would need to consider telling the courts you and ignore any such court order?
I did not suggest that there would be any need to consider ignoring court orders. At the point of that meeting, there were no court orders to discuss.
Well, did you suggest telling the courts you in any manner?
I don't recall.
You just don't remember that.
And one of the world's richest men faced a wave of wedding crashers as activists in the canal city of Venice disrupted Jeff Bezos' nuptials this week to protest what they call Bezos' takeover of the famed city. Guests at the multimillion-dollar wedding between Bezos and former TV news anchor Lauren Sanchez include the Clintons, Oprah Winfrey, Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner. On Monday, activists unfurled a giant banner on Venice's San Marco Square, reading, "If you can rent Venice for your wedding, you can pay more tax." This is Simona Abate, a campaigner with Greenpeace Italy.
The problem is not the wedding. The problem is the system. We think that one big billionaire can't rent a city for his pleasure. We think that we need to tax the people that have a huge number of money and use this money for reduce the impact of climate change, to increase the healthcare system, to increase the welfare state.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. In a stunning victory earlier this week, 33-year-old Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani won the Democratic primary in the race to be mayor of New York City, sending shockwaves through the Democratic Party across the country. Mamdani was the top choice of 43.5% of Democratic primary voters in New York's ranked choice system. He defeated former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who conceded the race Tuesday night. If Zohran Mamdani wins in the general election in November, he will be the city's youngest mayor in over a century, as well as the first Muslim mayor of New York. He won with an energetic campaign that brought in tens of thousands of volunteers and a laser focus on the issue of affordability.
We have won because New Yorkers have stood up for a city they can afford. A city where they can do more than just struggle. One where those who toil in the night can enjoy the fruits of their labor in the day. Where hard work is repaid with a stable life. Where 8 hours on the factory floor or behind the wheel of a cab is enough to pay the mortgage. It is enough to keep the lights on. It is enough to send your kid to school. Where rent-stabilized apartments are actually stabilized. Where buses are fast and free. Where childcare doesn't cost more than CUNY. And where public safety keeps us truly safe.
Just as stunning as Zohran Mamdani's victory is the defeat of the former governor. Andrew Cuomo entered the primary as the easy front-runner, with broad name recognition and the support from the largest super PAC ever in New York City mayoral primary history. The PAC, called Fix the City, shattered all previous records, raising more than $25 million to back Cuomo's attempt at a political comeback, 4 years after he resigned over sexual misconduct allegations by at least 11 women who were former staffers.
How did this earthquake, this massive upset happen? And what does it say about the Democratic Party and Democratic voters in this moment that the campaign of a Democratic socialist focused on affordability beat out such formidable establishment opponent? We're joined now by someone who's made teaching about rising inequality and its impacts on society his life work. Robert Reich has held many positions over his career, Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, best-selling author, prolific creator of viral videos online, and co-founder of Inequality Media. But above all, he considers himself a teacher. He's been a professor for over 40 years. In fact, he just taught his last class, at least for now. Yes, there's a new film out about Robert Reich, which is called Just That, The Last Class. And it looks at this last semester teaching at UC Berkeley, the course Wealth and Poverty, Wealth and Inequality. Here's a clip from the film.
I try to be mindful of the world these students are entering. I was talking with some of them recently, and I asked, you're no longer Generation Z. What do you call yourself? What's the generation after Generation Z? What are you? And they, several of them said, we're the last generation.
The last generation. Robert Reich joins us in our studio here in New York because the film, The Last Class, is premiering this weekend at the IFC. But you are coming at, to say the least, an extremely significant moment in New York's history, in the country's history. You endorsed Mamdani. You endorsed Zohran Mamdani early on. That is certainly more than the Democratic leaders of the city have done. Even after this victory, technically it's in a week because it's ranked choice voting and the results will come out next week. But he got 43% of the vote at a time when, at some point, Andrew Cuomo was something like 40 points ahead. And I think what Mamdani said is his own name recognition was at 1%, and maybe that was an exaggeration, he said. But the name of your class, Wealth and Poverty, very much signifies the significance of this campaign, the very issues he addressed, where right now, New York Senator Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, leader of the Democrats in the House, they kind of congratulated him, but they didn't even endorse him at this point. Talk about the shockwaves and what you think this suggests for the future.
Well, shockwaves is a good way of putting it, Amy. The Democratic Party really needs to learn this lesson. It's a lesson that over the last 40 years, it could have learned over and over again, But the lesson is very simple. There is a huge anti-establishment wave in America. That is the most, that's the strongest wave in American politics. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that the bottom 60 to 80% of Americans have not seen a real wage increase in 45 years. You know, people are doing a little bit better than they did 45 years ago, but the people at the top are doing wonderfully well. I mean, they're having weddings in Venice. There's so much conspicuous consumption at the top. Wealth has moved, has been siphoned off, and it's because the economy is rigged. I mean, I hate to say it. This is the one thing that I agree with Donald Trump about. The economy is rigged, but it's rigged against working class people, and I think Mamdani understood that. He understood that people have got to want a change, but also they want affordability. They want an economy that is working for them. And they want new faces. They want younger people. They want a new generation of Democratic leaders.
I mean, one of the features, winning features of Zohran Mamdani's campaign was a series of interviews that he conducted in parts of New York City that had previously voted Democrat, but in this election went Trump. And I think what you're saying, that, you know, this is where you agree with Trump, that the economy is rigged, that in part explains why people shifted from the Democratic Party to Trump, the people that Mamdani spoke to. And he came to see, in fact, that the problem was affordability. So if you could elaborate a little bit more on how you think this was the perhaps determining issue in this kind of surge towards Trump and the Republican Party in the last election.
Well, it's clear that Trump fooled the majority of Americans, or at least a plurality, into thinking that he would be their savior. He would be doing something about prices. He would actually be responding to the needs of average working people. Now, he hasn't, obviously. He didn't in his first term. Remember, the major thing he did in his first term was a big tax cut, mostly for the rich. That's what he's doing now. Again, another big tax cut, mostly for the rich. But he uses the symbols of cultural populism, like immigration, to persuade a lot of people that he's on their side. Now, I'm not suggesting Democrats go in that direction. Quite the contrary. I think Democrats need to go in the direction of economic populism. They need to talk about the reality, and that is that wealth and income are really almost at a record level, moving to the top. And it is no accident. This is because of huge amounts of money spent in politics by big corporations and the wealthy. But what's wonderful, and I think Democrats really should take some solace from this, about the Mamdani's campaign, is that you had the biggest war chest in modern American politics against him. You had Bill Clinton endorsing him.
Your boss.
My former boss. Not my boss anymore. And you have the Democratic establishment really making a kind of last-ditch effort to do everything they possibly could for him. And they failed miserably. If there's not a lesson here about people rising, demanding what they want and what they need, and a new generation of Democrats rising, talking to people authentically about what they need, I don't know what the lesson is.
So, I mean, we want to, talk about the fact that you were also, you're saying all of this not as someone who's an outsider, but someone who served in successive Democratic administrations. So we'd like to go back over 30 years and turn to a speech you gave in 1994 at the Democratic Leadership Council when you were still the Secretary of Labor for Bill Clinton.
My friends, we are on the way to becoming a two-tiered society, composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind, whose anger and whose disillusionment is easily manipulated. Once unbottled, mass resentment can poison the very fabric of society, the moral integrity of a society. Replacing ambition with envy, replacing tolerance with hate. Today, the targets of that rage, and we see it around us. You can only read the daily paper. You don't have far to look. Today, the targets of that rage, are immigrants and welfare mothers and government officials and gays and an ill-defined counterculture. But as the middle class continues to erode, who will be the targets tomorrow?
So that's you, Robert Reich, speaking in 1994 when you were still Labor Secretary for Bill Clinton. You've described this moment as your 1994 warning about Trumpism. So if you could elaborate on that, and also when you came to be totally disillusioned with the Democratic Party.
I came to be disillusioned with the Democratic Party years ago, before I was Secretary of Labor. But, you know, Democrats, these parties, these things called political parties are no longer what they used to be. They are basically fundraising machines. Donald Trump has made the Republican Party into a not just a cult, but a very dangerous, dictatorial kind of systemic structure. But let me just say that when I said in 1994 that if inequality continued to widen and the middle class continued to shrink, that we would see a demagogue coming along, what I meant was that we would create the conditions in which a lot of Americans were desperate enough that they would vote for a demagogue. And obviously, Donald Trump did come along. He has fooled a lot of people. He continues to fool a lot of people. He's a con man. We all know he's a con man. But unless the Democrats come up with somebody who's truthful, you know, who has as much or if not more charisma, but is telling people what is actually happening, and talking in realistic terms about the economy and what and power. You know, the word power is a very important word here, and it's not used nearly enough. But the fact of the matter is that most Americans feel powerless. Most Americans feel that they have lost whatever power they had. And that's why I think they were looking for a strong man. This is a crisis right now. I don't have to tell you, you guys are doing a fabulous job. Thank you for what you're doing. But unless the Democratic Party, and we don't have a third party, we're not going to have a third party very easily, unless the Democratic Party really does respond to the moment. And why can't it? I mean, you have Donald Trump there with surrounded by billionaires, supported by billionaires, you know, creating a government by, for, and of billionaires. Why is this not the perfect time for the Democrats to emerge as the party of average working Americans once again?
When you were Labor Secretary, you opposed your own president's welfare reform, what many called welfare deform. Now you have the House Speaker, Johnson, saying that perhaps on Tuesday they're going to vote on the budget bill, what President Trump calls, of course, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, others call the One Deadly Bill Act. You have hundreds of millions of dollars in cuts in Medicaid. You have Democrats tinkering around the edges. But what do you think needs to happen at this point? Zohran Mamdani has said the only answer to organize money is organize people. This is a message you've had for decades.
He's exactly right. And this is a time for people to say, no, in a very mass way. I mean, we see mass demonstrations. That demonstration we had recently was the biggest demonstration we've had in recent American history.
No kings, 5 million
no kings,
at least.
That's right.
Marching in the streets.
But, you know, we're not going to tolerate taking money from Medicaid and food stamps and nutrition and possibly from Medicare as well to give a big tax cut to the richest people in America when they've never been as rich. This is not this is not something that any political person, any political advisor should find terribly complicated. It's not something that any Democrat should find complicated. This is giving the Democratic Party a platter on which to develop a platform. And you see what Mamdani did. This is an era not unlike the 1930s in terms of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the need.
He says free buses. He says freeze the rent. He says that kids have to have free child care. What's interesting is de Blasio, the most popular program he ever did when people were saying, no, you can't possibly afford this, was this pre-K school for kids all over the city, absolutely free. One of the most popular programs in New York City.
Well, you need people. You know, this is, again, this is not complicated stuff. People do need help with childcare. People are working. Women and men are working harder than ever.
How do
people,
you pay for it?
Well, we're the richest country in the world. We've never been richer. Amy, this is what Democrats have got to say. We pay for it by raising taxes on the wealthy. We pay for it with a wealth tax. We pay for it the ways in which, Teddy Roosevelt, you don't even have to go back to Franklin D. Roosevelt, his fifth cousin Teddy Roosevelt in 1901 was contemplating and developed sort of a wealth tax in terms of an estate tax. There are things that can be done and should be done, and Democrats cannot be afraid of sounding, what, socialist, radical? This is the time for sounding a little bit strong.
You're here in New York City for your film, The Last Class, which is premiering at the Quad in New York City. You are President Trump turned 79 on June 19th, no King's Day protests against his big birthday military parade. 5 million people marched. You just turned 79 as well. You're like 5-6 days apart. Your final message on what needs to happen?
Well, I mean, you know, George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and Donald Trump and I also were born within a month and a half of each other under slightly different signs. Maybe that's the difference. But what has to happen is we've got to have a Democratic Party that is not afraid, that doesn't take big money, that says to big corporations and Wall Street, too bad, we are going to represent the people. That's the direction we're going in, and we're not going to hear anything different. And the corporate Democrats, goodbye.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. It's great to have you in studio. Robert Reich, former labor secretary, best-selling author, subject of the new film, The Last Class, about his last class that he taught last year at UC Berkeley, Wealth and Poverty. Was it over 1,000 students attended that class?
Yep.
Up next, the Trump administration's attack on vaccines. Stay with us.
Recoge solo tus ideas, levanta paga tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
El día que amanece lento, recoge solo tus ideas, levanta paga tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega, el tiempo que flota en el aire, las horas al viento
me
se entregan. Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega, el tiempo que flota en el aire y el viento se entrega.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo sueltan, en tu pecho una llamarada que por dentro quema.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo suelta, en tu pecho una llamada que todo lo quema.
Me
te está llamando. Y me está llamando. Óyelo.
Me está llamando.
Un fuego que todo lo quema, un fuego que todo lo quema. Responde que te está llamando, responde que te está,
me llamando.
Está llamando. Un fuego que por donde quema, un fuego que todo lo quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema, un fuego que todo
me
lo quema.
Yama by Maku Sound System, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to public health and vaccines. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has withdrawn a U.S. pledge to fund the world's preeminent international vaccine organization as the Trump administration takes its campaign against vaccinations, led by RFK Jr., global. The organization, known as Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, is the world's largest funder of life-saving vaccinations and says it's helped vaccinate more than 1.1 billion children in 78 lower-income countries, preventing nearly 19 million future deaths. On Wednesday, Kennedy claimed, without any evidence, that Gavi, quote, ignored the science in its global immunization campaign.
Unfortunately, in its zeal to promote universal vaccination, it has neglected the key issue of vaccine safety. When the science was inconvenient, Gavi ignored the science. I call on Gavi today to re-earn the public trust and to justify the $8 billion that America has provided in funding since 2001.
Also Wednesday, scientists at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control rallied outside the agency's headquarters in Atlanta to protest the Trump administration's newly reconstituted vaccine advisory panel. It's called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, known as ACIP. RFK Jr. stacked the committee with new appointees, fired most of the others, many of them holding anti-vaccine views. He fired all 17 formerly seated members of the panel and replaced them with a smaller group of his own. Wednesday was the first day of the new committee's meeting. This is former CDC worker Peter Kieglowski, who was protesting outside.
There have been rallies here every Tuesday since March, but today is especially important because this is the first meeting of this new, and I would say bogus, Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, ACIP. Kennedy, as most people know, fired the previous members of ACIP, and the few people that he's put on it are not competent.
For more on these developments, we're joined by Dr. Paul Offit. He's the director of the Vaccine Education Center, attending physician at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, also serves as an advisor to the FDA. Dr. Offit is the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, recommended for universal use in infants by the CDC, author of numerous books, including Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and The Search for a Cure, as well as the book Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. Dr. Offit, thanks so much for joining us again. If you can start off by talking about this two-day meeting, the first was yesterday, and the whole issue that the people on this committee are saying they're just reexamining the whole roster of vaccines. What does that mean? How does that affect kids in this country, adults as well, and people around the world?
Well, so anti-vaccine activists have been shouting from the sidelines for decades. Now they're making policy. We have an anti-vaccine activist and science denialist as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who basically fired 17 people who were members of the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, who went through the proper vetting process, made sure they didn't have conflicts of interest, made sure they had the expertise that could give us the advice we needed. He fired all those people. Then what he did is he brought in eight people. Now one of them backed off. So it's seven people who would have never passed the confirmation process, who don't have the expertise we need to give good advice. And what they're doing is they're just putting forward what is typically anti-vaccine tropes, like kids are getting too many vaccines too soon, so we need to reevaluate that. Why are we giving a hepatitis B birth dose, et cetera, et cetera? And so you're now just seeing anti-vaccine activism move into the center of public health.
And Dr. Offit, in fact, the panel chair, Dr. Robert Malone, said he considers the label anti-vaxxer to be high praise. I mean, you've worked in vaccine information, the head director of the Vaccine Education Center. You know, what do you think explains this transformation in the perception of the effectiveness of vaccines, and not just the effectiveness, but what they're propagating, which is the danger of vaccines?
I think that we, to some extent, lost the trust of the American public early in the COVID pandemic. And I think two things happened. I think in 2020, when we didn't have anything, we didn't have antivirals until October, we didn't have monoclonal antibodies till November, we didn't have vaccines till December, to try and stop the spread of a virus that was spread asymptomatically. And so what did we do? We shuttered schools, we closed businesses, we restricted travel, we masked, isolated, quarantined, social distanced, and tested. And I think there was a percentage of this population that thought that was massive government overreach, especially the shuttering of schools and closing of businesses. I think the following year, when we had a vaccine, which we did by December of 2020, and that was available by January of 2021, we very quickly vaccinated 70% of this population by July of 2021. But 30% of this population didn't want to be vaccinated. First of all, people didn't like it that you had to have your vaccine passport, which is to say, unless you were vaccinated, you couldn't go to your favorite bar or restaurant or a place of worship, or you may be fired from your job. That, too, was, I think, seen as massive government overreach. And I think we leaned into a libertarian left hook, and I think we're feeling that punch. So everything sort of fell out. I mean, people said, well, COVID's not that big of a deal, or, well, the vaccine is really much more dangerous than they're telling you. They lost the trust in the government, and they were very quick to see conspiracy. And that's how RFK Jr. rose into this position. I mean, what did he say when he fired those 17 people? He said they were rife with conflicts of interest, which wasn't true. He couldn't name one person on that committee who had a conflict of interest that in any way affected their vote, not one. So instead, he just had this broad sweeping, you know, they're all in the pocket of industry, they're all unduly influenced. And then to extend this to Gavi, to the Global Alliance Vaccine Initiative, you couldn't be more short-sighted. How do people think measles comes into this country periodically and can start outbreaks? It's coming from often from outside the country, because every year there's millions of cases of measles. There's almost 150,000 deaths from measles in this year. And the Global Alliance Vaccine Initiative has done a lot of good at sort of stopping the spread of things like measles and German measles, et cetera. So it's hard to watch all this.
Dr. Offit, I want to ask you to respond to RFK Jr.'s appointee, the co-chair, Martin Kulldorff, who kicked off Wednesday's panel. He said he's appointing a working group to look at the, quote, cumulative effect of the children's vaccine schedule.
If you have questions or concerns about the safety or efficacy of vaccines, we want to hear them. That is the scientific method, and it is natural to ask questions. That is what the CDC subject matter experts do. It's what the public does, and it is what we will do. No questions should be off limits. Some media outlets have been very harsh on the new members of this committee, issuing false accusations and making concerted efforts to put scientists in either a pro or anti-vaccine box. Such labels undermine critical scientific inquiry, and it further feeds the flames of vaccine hesitancy. As Secretary Kennedy has eloquently stated, opposing mercury in fish does not make you anti-fish, and opposing mercury in vaccines does not make you anti-vaccine. In fact, to thoroughly scrutinize and ensure the safety and efficacy of vaccines is a pro-vaccine position.
So, Dr. Offit, Martin Kulldorff is just saying we're just looking at all of this. But what is your response? And talk not only what it means here. Again, you were referring to Gavi. What this means globally. Why saying evaluation is perfectly innocent and reasonable and scientific.
Well, that's true. I think evaluation is perfectly reasonable, but you don't necessarily need to evaluate things that are already clear. So, for example, when he talks about this notion that we're just getting too many vaccines, that we need to look at the entire vaccine schedule, it shows you that he really doesn't understand the immunology of vaccines, which is true of most of the people sitting around that table. They don't have the expertise in virology or immunology or vaccinology. So, for example, people say, look, I mean, we're asking so much of parents of this country, and it's true. You know, we ask them to give vaccines that prevent 14 different diseases in the first few years of life. That can mean as many as 25 inoculations during that time and as many as 5 shots at one time to prevent diseases most people don't see, using biological fluids most people don't understand. So there's understandable skepticism, and that's fair. But it's not really the number of vaccines that you get that matters. It's the number of immunological components in vaccines that matter. So by immunological component, I mean, for example, a viral protein or bacterial protein that induces an immune response. That's an immunological component. If you add up all the immunological components in vaccines today, it adds up to about 170. That's less than the one vaccine that we got 100 years ago. the smallpox vaccine, the largest of the mammalian viruses, which had about 200 immunological components. So we have a lesser challenge to the immune system today in vaccines than we did 100 years ago. So I don't think he understands any of that. And I think when he brings these things up is, look, we're just asking questions, and brings up the mercury issue again. I mean, I was on the advisory committee for immunization practices between 1998 and 2003 when this all came up. And this has been well studied. We now have looked at children who get these vaccines that contain this mercury, so-called ethyl mercury preservative, compared it to children who have the same vaccines that didn't contain this mercury-containing preservative. And you know, because we live on this planet and that mercury is in the Earth's crust and that we drink methyl mercury every day, and that we all have methylmercury in our bloodstreams, all of us, methylmercury is in infant formula. It's in breast milk. It's in anything made from water on this planet. What you learned about so-called thimerosal, this ethylmercury-containing preservative, is that it doesn't in any way contribute to a detectable amount of mercury in your bloodstream. You knew that. And then there's now been 9 studies showing that if you get these vaccines, as compared to vaccines that don't contain this preservative, that there's no difference in neurodevelopmental outcome. So when he says, well, we're just asking questions, we're just looking, we've already looked at this. What he's saying is he doesn't trust what's happened before him.
And Dr. Offit, the question about the global impacts of this, first the U.S. cutting funding to Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and then this coupled with the fact that for multiple reasons, vaccination rates in many parts of the world, including poorer countries, have come down in part because of vaccine misinformation that spread and the impact on that on possible future deaths.
Certainly. I mean, we export our fears, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been a big exporter of fears. I mean, since he's been an anti-vaccine activist for 20 years through his program, Children's Health Defense, he puts out a lot of misinformation and disinformation. And so, for example, Samoa is a perfect example. There was a tragedy in Samoa where the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is in powdered form there. So you need to dilute it or reconstitute it in a diluent. Two nurses independently made a mistake where instead of using just the sort of salt water diluent that should have been used, they use a muscle relaxant. They injected independently 2 12-month-old children, both of whom died almost immediately when they stopped breathing. So what he did immediately through Children's Health Defense, as he said in his website and then elsewhere, a measles vaccine is killing children in Samoa when it wasn't a vaccine at all. He then went to Samoa. He met with anti-vaccine activists. He met with the president. He tried to, again, influence people. Measles is killing your children. Immunization rates dropped from about 75% to 30%. And there was a massive measles outbreak in this country of 200,000 people. 5,600 cases of measles, 83 deaths, mostly in children less than 4 years of age. That he had a lot to do with that. So that's what misinformation can do, not only in this country, where we're again seeing the biggest measles outbreak we've probably seen in 30 years, but in the world.
So finally, 30 seconds, how are you responding to this 2-day meeting and what's going to come out of it?
You're just standing back and watching what is frankly a clown show. I mean, I think the head of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Susan Kresley, said it best. We're not going to this meeting anymore. We're ignoring this meeting. I think most of the medical and scientific community is just seeing this for what it is, which is just another forum for anti-vaccine activists to talk about their misinformation.
Dr. Paul Offit, we want to thank you for being with us, director of the Vaccine Education Center, attending physician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Up next, NATO. Stay with us.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. If you love just one nation, then the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, there is no other choice. But God bless the people then who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies. We can bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution to from hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. I sing
Bomb the World to Pieces by Michael Franti in our Democracy Now! Studio years ago. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
President Trump is back in Washington after the NATO summit, where leaders agreed to increase their military spending to 5% of their GDP by 2035. The NATO summit occurred just days after Trump ordered an attack on three Iranian nuclear sites. This is Trump speaking with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte about the Israel-Iran ceasefire, which continues to hold.
They're not going to be fighting each other. They've had it. They've had a big fight, like two kids in a schoolyard. You know, they fight like hell. You can't stop them. Let them fight for about 2-3 minutes. Then it's easier to stop them.
And then daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
Every once in a while, you have to use a certain word.
That was President Trump and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who referred to Trump as daddy. Earlier today, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei issued a video statement where he claimed Iran had won the war and vowed that Iran would never surrender.
This all comes as Israel's mass killing in Gaza continues. Palestinian officials say Israeli forces have killed another 90 Palestinians over the last 24 hours, including dozens waiting near new food distribution centers. To talk more about NATO, Iran, and Gaza, we go to London, where we're joined by Gilbert Ashkar, Emeritus Professor of Development Studies and International Relations at SOAS, University of London. He's the author of several books, including The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. His recent piece for the French paper Le Monde is headlined History's Crossroads, Gaza or the Failure of the West. And he's writing a new book. It's just about to come out, Gaza Catastrophe, the Genocide in World Historical Perspective. Professor Ashkar, it's great to have you with us. Let's start off by what came out of NATO. Trump has been pushing this since his first term, that the 32 member countries spend far more on weapons, which means cutting social programs, green programs. And you have the NATO Secretary General sitting next to him, Mark Rutte, calling Trump daddy. Your response?
Yeah. Good morning, Amy, and good morning, Nermeen. Very nice talking to you. Well, that was a pathetic spectacle that we've seen, this NATO summit. That was the shortest of all NATO summits, probably. I mean, it was cut to the size that fits the attention span of Donald Trump, which is no longer than 2 hours, seemingly. I mean, if you just imagine that you have 32 countries represented there, just divide the 2 hours by 32, you'll see how long it gives everyone. And the result was, very, very much meant to please Donald Trump. This decision that you mentioned to increase military expenditure to the level of 5% of GDP, which is a very high level, even if you take into account that that means practically 3.5% for strictly military expenditure and 1.5 on security and other kind of related expenditure, that's still absolutely huge. And for many, many of those 32 countries of NATO, that would mean doubling, more than doubling for some, their military expenditure. That's absolutely huge and can only happen, as it is happening in the United States, where you have record military budgets with Donald Trump, and cutting in Medicaid, cutting in social expenditure of every kind. You know that better than I know. So that's exactly what is going to happen at the level of the whole of NATO, and is happening. And basically, this meeting was a convergence between two factors. One, the Trump factor, of course, but we have to be aware of the fact that Trump does not really give a damn about NATO itself. He doesn't regard Russia as an enemy. He actually has more affinities with Vladimir Putin than most of these European leaders. And the summit proved that. I mean, there were hardly a mention, just one, of Russia. What he is interested in is catering to the military-industrial complex of the United States. And when he asks these NATO countries to increase their military expenditure, he means by that, buy more U.S. weapons. That's what he is doing. He's a salesperson for the military-industrial complex, along with the Trump Organization and other businesses. With the Gulf countries, it's exactly the same. He got them to promise hundreds of billions of dollars of expenditure on military purchases. And so you have a convergence between that. And now the military-industrial complex of those European countries that have a large military industry, and that is mostly countries like Germany, France, Britain, the United Kingdom, that is, and Poland, and these are the countries that are now pushing for more military expenditure. And you can see that most of the countries where you don't have such industries are very reluctant to follow. So there is this convergence of interest of military industrial complexes wanting more money, more expenditure on means of destruction at the very time when we are lacking every kind of things. And you know, just to give you an illustration of someone who got the lesson, because he is following in the footsteps of the poodle tradition of Tony Blair, and that's Keir Starmer. I mean, he is happily increasing the military budget of the United Kingdom, and part of that is buying, just a very recent decision, 12 F-35 from the United States at a cost that has been estimated overall, hardware plus what comes with it, at close to $2 billion. These are planes that will be able to carry nuclear loads, but that would be under U.S. control. I mean, the use of these nuclear weapons. So that's also an abandon of sovereignty. So you have this from a government in Britain at the time when you have the National Health Service completely understaffed. And there you have Keir Starmer explaining to the public opinion in this country, in Britain, that this purchase of 12 F-35s will create a huge lot of jobs. I mean, this is pitiful, absolutely pitiful.
And Gilbert Achecard, very quickly, you said that NATO, that Trump doesn't care about NATO, but NATO seems to care an enormous amount for Trump. So if you could just say a little bit about that, we just have 30 seconds.
Yes, I mean, it's uneven in NATO, but of course, the closer you get to the Russia, the Russian borders, the more countries are afraid and need or believe that they need U.S. protection. And you have some of those states, the larger states, those who have military industrial complexes, as I said, if you look at France and Germany in particular, trying to push forward the idea of an autonomous European defense, but it's not very popular in NATO ranks. Even Britain, as I said, does not follow at all that kind of line. Now, this being said, we are witnessing the recurrence of a pattern that was very familiar during the Cold War, where the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex in the United States would inflate considerably the so-called risk, the threat, the communist threat or whatever it is, the threat from the Soviet Union,
in order to increase
their military expenditure. Yep.
We're going to go to part two, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org, so people should check out the website for a web exclusive with Gilbert Achecard, Professor Emeritus of Development Studies and International Relations at SOAS, the University of London. That does it for our show. We're hiring for multiple positions. Go to democracynow.org/jobs. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!